When is writing teaching? We'll ask today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Dan Lee is a college professor, author, and columnist. He's also our guest today on Scribble. Where does teaching end and writing begin, or vice versa, Dan?
Well, they interface to a considerable extent. There are things I've written that pick up on what I've discussed in my classes. There are also things that I've written that inform my teaching in my classes. So it's a two-way street.
You know, last week we talked to another columnist in the same paper, Shane Brown, who has a very different approach to writing. But, well, you know, when you sit down to the books that you've authored, do they grow out of what you have taught? Are they an extension of that, or how do the two interface?
In many cases, the answer is yes, they have grown out of what I've taught, though in part they are an extension as well, because the books give me an opportunity to explore new areas and new ideas.
Mm-hmm. But how do books do that, writing do that, in a way that classroom doesn't? I assume you discuss ethics in your classroom too, right?
Well, that's my assumption, since I teach courses in ethics. What writing does is that it forces one to focus one's thoughts in ways that the classroom doesn't always. In the classroom, we tend to cover a lot of different areas, a lot of different topics. When you write, you have to narrow the focus. And if I might comment on writing for the students, it is a very important part of their intellectual development. It's a very important part of the learning process for them. I require a major paper, a 3,000-word paper, in all of my courses. A lot of people don't do that today, but I'm still old school. I think it's good. And for most of my classes, including the one that I'm teaching right now, I go through process writing. I require a proposal. I'll meet with each student to discuss his proposal. I require a rough draft. I'm completing the meetings with the students now to talk about the rough drafts, and then a final draft. And that results in a far higher quality of writing and intellectual engagement than is the case if one doesn't have that type of interaction.
Plus, it's the way things are done in the real world, right?
That's true.
I can recall when I first came, you assigned a theme a week, the student made his mistakes, and then went on to the next theme, made more mistakes. But it makes real sense to do it the way you're doing it. I mean, because if they are going to write in the real world, and they are almost always, even though they think they won't, that's how they're going to have to do it.
That is correct, and it better prepares them for life in the real world after graduation from Augustana. Now, not everyone gains from the experience. I think of a student, this was a number of years ago, but he emailed me to say that he was having a latency problem with his paper. and you know what happened? Latency turned into flunkency.
But now, do you follow the same exacting procedure when you write a column?
To some extent, the answer is yes. Mm-hmm. I have in my head, I'm usually 2 or 3 weeks in advance in terms of what I will be writing, so it's not last minute.
Boy, I can see Wooten's eyes popping right as
we
speak.
Do we differ on that?
In fact, I can tell you right now what I'll be writing in the next 2 weeks, but I'm not going to do it.
Oh, no.
I'm not going to tell you. But I do some initial thinking about it. I do some research in a number of cases, running down information that I need. And then I write the initial draft. And I spend as much time with the revisions as I do with the initial draft.
Hmm. Yeah, by revision, do you mean changing a word here and there, or sometimes is it rewritten almost completely?
Well, it's seldom that I rewrite it completely, but given the nature of academic types, we tend to go on at greater length than we really need to. So the first stage in the process is coming up with a draft to work with, and that's often 800, maybe even 900 words. Our editor doesn't like
right.
that.
No.
And then I spend considerable time trimming it down and go through it and ask, you know, do I really need this? Do I really need that? And it's surprising how much you don't really need. Then I finally get something that's 650 to 725 words and do a little more polishing and then turn it in.
I don't know this for a fact, but just, you know, bumping into you from time to time when we were both teaching at Augie, I would dare say you have written probably twice as much as almost any other faculty member at Augustana, and that's saying a lot. Every time I talked to you, you were both finishing a book and thinking about starting a new one. And maybe you had other ideas that were floating around there. How in the world did you end up, I mean, how many books have you written?
Oh, I've published 10 books of different genres.
Yeah.
They're not all academic books. Some of them are. Some of them are not. But I find that intellectually stimulating, it keeps me alive. There are a couple of reasons that I'm still teaching in my 45th year of teaching. One is the students. I just love working with the students, and they really motivate me and keep me going. But the other thing is that I always have writing projects in the hopper or things that I'm working on. I look at my colleagues who retired, who are far younger than I am, and with rare exception, they were not active in writing. So, you know, writing reinvigorates one.
You know, writing, though, for me is, I remember reading Make It the Full Man, Conference of Ready Man, writing an exact man. Well, yeah, exact man, except that people can read what you write. Whereas when you're talking, you can immediately shift gears and change. You can you have emphasis. And when you write, though, there it is. It's kind of cold.
Yeah.
It's sitting there on the paper. You can't deny it. It's there. So I'm a little hesitant to be that precise because I'm not sure about anything.
I could go on and on about writing, but I want to talk about what you write. You're the ethics teacher at Augie, right?
That's correct.
Somebody wanted to know the other day, knowing that we were going to record you today, what is the difference between ethics and morals?
Well, actually, there's much debate about that
in
the field.
Well, to you.
But I tend to collapse the two of them with the caveat that morals have more to do with social norms in society, while ethical reasoning is more reflective in nature.
For example?
To stop and think about what fairness might involve in a situation, that often takes a good deal of reflection. There are a lot of people who have strongly held views, but there's a certain sense to paraphrase Socrates a little bit, that an unexamined belief or an unexamined view is a view that's not worth having.
Well, you know, I think of fictional characters, and you've seen this sometimes, I think in maybe in movies, where maybe a detective nails somebody on something and then decides, I'm going to let him go. And I think, okay, how does that square with ethics or morality? You know, when do you show mercy? When do you insist on justice? And it seems to me those two things are different, mercy and justice.
They can be, yes, they can be. But one other thing that comes into play here, too, I think of Reinhold Niebuhr, a high-impact 20th century theologian, and he said, he argued that we never have perfect justice. We only have relative justice. We try to get it as close to the ideal as possible, but our decisions are always, to some extent, flawed.
Well, you know, it's true that when you get a set of ethics or a set of principles, and you try to apply those equally in every situation, they don't work. They really don't. There's always an exception. And that was the thing I found in legislation. You never knew for sure how this legislation was going to work. Because, you know, I think I've covered all the bases, but sure enough, right away, an exception would show up.
And what's often the case is that we have competing prima facie obligations where we can't do everything. No textbook example of that is you're taking an ill family member to the hospital in the middle of the night. You come to a red light at an intersection. Do you stop or drive on through? Well, you have the obligation to get your family member to the hospital. You have the obligation to comply with traffic laws, which takes priority. And many people, and yes, I myself have done this, will drive through the red light. So now you know that I'm a fugitive from justice.
Well, a friend of mine, a priest, was going to say Mass at a distance on a snowy night. He came up to an intersection, was not a car in sight. He stopped at the stop sign and couldn't get his car going.
A big mistake, right?
Yeah, he was tempted to go right through the stop sign. But he says, but it irritates me that I didn't have the judgment to just keep going because I knew my car was having hiccups and there I was stuck. But you try to explain that to a state trooper, and I don't think it'll work.
It would not. Yeah. It would not. Don't. I've never been in that situation, but don't try it. You know, there's something else I want to say here, and that is that when you talk about making good ethical decisions, having good ethical values, critical thinking is a very important part of it. Instead of just putting on the blinders and looking at things narrowly, I'll tell you one of the most important lessons in ethics that I ever learned, and it wasn't from my confirmation pastor, it wasn't from a teacher, it was from an admiral in the Navy who chewed the daylights out of me. And the situation was, I was in naval intelligence, and the mission started developing in an unexpected way, and he was with us on the mission. That wasn't necessarily to our liking, but I had no say in the matter. He called a staff meeting, and he turned to me and said, Lieutenant Lee, what do you recommend that we do? And I said, sir, our orders are to follow these people, and we're reporting regularly back to fleet headquarters. If they want us to do something different, they'll let us know. And the admiral just blew up and slammed his fist on the table. He said, Lieutenant Lee, we always assume total responsibility for what we do. And after what seemed like an eternity, he asked me, Lieutenant, now what do you think we should do? And I said, sir, let's inquire of Fleet Headquarters whether they want us to continue the mission or break it off. We did. They said, break it off. And we avoided a diplomatic crisis by doing that. But see, the problem so often is that people have their blinders on and they act almost reflexively and say, well, you know, our orders are our orders. This is what we're supposed to be doing. And they never stop and think about it. So in my ethics classes, I try to get students to stop and think about what they're doing.
Sometimes it's hard to stop and think.
Do you notice a difference in students from when you began back in 1974?
Yes. For the most part, it's a positive difference. They are more willing to question what I say and what various authors say. Rather than just accept at face value everything that's said, I think of a student who was in one of my classes shortly after I started teaching, and he came up to me at the end of the period and said, I thought this was going to be a course in ethics, but all you gave us was a lot of questions. Well, there's a reason for that. You need to stop and think about what you're doing.
So if a student is more questioning at the end of your class, are you a success?
I like to think so.
Okay.
Very much so, yeah. And if a student realizes that we live in a world of ambiguities, a world in which there aren't always clear-cut answers, that I view as a plus, not as a minus.
You know, it's reading a book by Harari, various little lectures, some good, some indifferent. But he talks about we do change. We think that we never change. He talks about Orthodox rabbis taking out pictures of women in news reports and so on. He says archaeologists have found old sites of Hebrew worship with women depicted and sometimes not too carefully dressed. He says, so you can't say that we don't change. We do. Mm-hmm. And what changes? Ethics or morality? How do you construct? I'm wondering now, when we are living in a time where we don't follow carefully the rules of the past, how are we going to organize a community? It seems to me we have to find a way to get together, to get along. And before that, there was a template you followed when you grew up. I knew exactly what I was supposed to do when I was a kid. I have no idea now. And I think I wonder how society organizes itself from this point on.
And that's a very real concern. What is desperately lacking is dialogue, understanding. There is far too much polarization and people just attacking each other, and that to me is very very worrisome. Now, I think that one part of our job, those of us who are in education, is to help our students develop their listening skills. Now, we talk a lot about writing skills, and part of this segment, we talk about critical thinking skills, but we don't talk much about listening skills, and I think we need to do more of that.
That's true. That is exactly true. And listening to people is important, and that's why this program is just a conversation, where we listen to one another and feed off of what we say. So many times I hear on radio and on TV interviews, set questions. And it doesn't make any difference what answer you get. You go on to the next question. Mm-hmm. I think, well, how do you find out anything that way? There has to be some kind of give and take, an exploration. But how do you develop that?
You know, let me share with you an anecdote. Several years ago, I wrote a a book on intergenerational issues. That's not my best-selling book. It's not the most important book that I've written, but it probably had the greatest impact on me while I wrote it, because I came to the conclusion that if there's to be justice among generations, we need to do a better job of listening to other generations, members of other generations. So while working on the book, I lined up interviews in various ways with people from different age groups. And it was, for me, an eye-opening experience. Some of them were people I had known for years, or at least thought I'd known for years, but I really had never listened to them, their life stories. Others were people I'd never met before, but it brought to my consciousness a better understanding of where other people are coming from. I think we ought to do more of those intergenerational types of things. I regret that I don't do them in the classes I teach. I maybe should go back to the drawing boards and add some intergenerational listening projects.
The minute, you think you found an answer, you haven't.
No.
That's right.
The thing is, society is sort of geared, even where you live, into separating the generations.
That's
right?
True.
Here's a retirement home, and here's a suburb for young people with new kids, and here's where the singles hang out and stuff. And instead, you know, if you could put a retirement home next to a grade school, both of them, and then had them interact, you would, I think, really have something.
I'll go back even further. Before the Great Depression, and actually during that time, there were usually three people in one home, three generations
right.
in one home.
Right.
Well,
and that's after the Second World War and the sudden prosperity it brought to all of society, people began to segregate and to follow the interests of that
right.
particular age group. And we gained something and we lost something. We gained a little more freedom, but we lost that transfer across generations.
It's one of the things that amazed me on one of the South American trips in places like Peru. You, on a Sunday morning, leaving church, there are three generations hand in hand walking down. You know, here, you don't see that very much.
But that's correct. And on one of the Latin American trips I was on, we were in Chapultepec Park in Mexico City on a Sunday afternoon, and you'd see three generations and extended family members there always playing with balloons. That's what's done in parks
right.
on Sunday
yeah.
afternoons. But what was interesting about it was that our students had gone to Mexico assuming that we were the haves and they were the have-nots because we tended to be more affluent. And after that afternoon in Chapultepec Park, when we met for class the next morning, the students started saying, wait, you know, we never do things like that. Our family never gets together and has fun like that. And they started questioning, and indeed they should have, who the
right.
real haves were
right.
and who the have-nots
yeah.
were.
Yeah,
and that's true. But here's the thing. We look at that and we see the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Now what? You're not going to get people to go back. You know, we are happy in our affluence. We're getting warnings now about we have maybe 10 years to stop global warming, and then after that, there's no hope. You think that's going to happen? I don't think so. I'm an optimist, but I have to work at being an optimist. How do you get people who are satisfied in their life to say, well, I guess I have to start making some sacrifices? I don't think that's going to happen.
Well, part of the problem is that a lot of people today have grown up in an era in which they didn't have to make sacrifices.
Yeah,
now,
right.
You'll go back to my grandparents' generation and the Great Depression and the World War II generation, they all knew what it was to make sacrifices and be part of a broader community. But then in the post-World War II years, greater affluence and in some respects, life was probably too easy.
Yeah. Before we run out of time, I have to ask you, how does your teaching of ethics and your preoccupation with that in writing books inform your column?
Well, I draw upon it from time to time. If the truth be known, if I'm really short on time and busy with other things, I will pull something out of one of my courses use for a call. So now I've let out a secret. That's not going to happen in the next 2 to 3 weeks I've mapped out, but it might happen during the week of finals.
Yeah, you're telling me you got all your columns done ahead of time. You're subject to the same pressures I am, Dan. But are you working on a book now?
Oh, I'm working on a book from time to time, though it's sort of on the back burner while I've been doing other things with teaching, and we're developing some exciting things via the Center for the Study of Ethics. The Center for the Study of Ethics is providing ethics modules for honors classes in area high schools, starting with United Township. They're the pilot project. It's going very well, and I expect we'll be expanding that to the other high schools on the Illinois side of the river.
Can you really teach ethics, or is it something you have to live?
Well, I think it's something that you have to experience. You can teach people what the questions are. You can identify the challenging issues, but there's no such thing as effective moral indoctrination, nor should they be. There be it was once the case where ethics classes were classes in moral indoctrination.
Right. Well,
that's long gone.
Not terribly long. When I came in 1960, you know, students, the religion department, you wouldn't recognize.
Yeah.
Today, right? The courses that you took the first 2 years, required courses, I mean, students called them Lutheran Bible Hour too, right? I mean, mm-hmm. it was continued indoctrination.
Well, and I'm told
that. And then in come you rabble rousers like Peter right. Beckman and Dan Lee, and Ralph Radloff. And,
we've unsettled the whole works.
You have unsettled the whole works, is true.
Well, you know, but that's the whole business. I've yelled on and on. We have no idea what life is, but we talk about how to live it and so on and describe it and everything. We have no idea what it is. But the whole business of trying to work your way through a life with some sense of satisfaction, satisfaction personal and satisfaction in terms of community and family, that's a tricky path to follow. And there are no sure guideposts, are there?
No, there aren't. There aren't. I think that what one has to do is proceed with compassion, with understanding, with a high level of humility, the recognizing that we don't have all of the answers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sometimes tough to do.
Well, you can always write a book about it, Dan.
The problem, as Melville said, is that partial acts have absolute consequences.
And right? That's true.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, we can sit and stew about this. But it is the most important and I think it's the most absorbing question, you know, about how to live a life. And, of course, that's pretty much what we're talking about with Dan Lee, who is a professor of ethics, an author of books, and a column. I'm Don Wooten with Roll Tweet. Thank you for being with us today. We're going to be back and have another shot at it next week on Scribble.